Good afternoon. So I'm going to do exam review to it today. The way that's going to work is I'm going to take things you want me to talk about. I'm going to get a list of those, going to go through them. If we get through them all, I'll take another list of things you want me to talk about, and that'll be what we do. If I don't give me anything to talk about, I'll just leave. So what would you like me to go over? So virtual memory example, like what sort of problem with virtual memory? Like, okay. What?
Going through like maybe like a two-page table, just like converting your virtual address to a physical address.
Okay, VA to VA, okay. Yeah.
Can we do a multi-level feedback queue scheduler question?
Okay. Anything more specific about them?
Kind of with like the timing, sort of like the last exam.
So okay, estimating how long things will run. Okay.
Yeah. Monitors and mutexes versus semaphores.
Mutexes versus semaphores can like how they're different or implementing one in terms of the other. Okay. Anything else? Any other? So, topics to. Yeah.
Like how to count context switches.
So counting context switches. Okay. Yeah. Okay, like what runs in fork? Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Quiz 4, question 2.
Which is about? So that is an MLFQ question, estimating how long until things start running. Okay. Other, yeah.
Databases and deadlocks.
Okay, anything more specific about them? I think they're separate topics, so.
I guess just general overview, I guess.
Okay, and back there. Which is about, so question 12 on spring 2019, which is about lock. Should have occurred to me that I would need to have the old exam locks and. Let's look up the actual question. Okay. Fill in. New blank with markers. Okay. Okay. Behind? Yeah. Page faults? Anything about them? Okay. When do they happen? Okay. Some of them? No? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Anything else? Are we all good? Yeah. Which is about something. First question is okay. System call arguments. Okay. And reader writer locks. Okay. So let's start with the flow of a system call. So we have there are several parts of things which run in a system call. So first we have sort of user library code. And in XV6, this was usys.s. We won't test you on file names in XV6, but this is so if you went to like very concrete example, you got it. Sys.s. This is the contains the special instruction to cause an exception and does any special argument setup. So in XV6, this argument, the way the arguments work is normal arguments, ones from C, pass the same way as C does normally, which implies on the stack, because that's how 32 works. And the system call number passed through EAX. And this is just a special argument setup. This is just a, OS's choice of calling convention for syscalls. So XV6 just made this choice. Other OS's could make different choices. But they had to choose how to pass the arguments. This is how they chose. Same way as user fractions for everything but which system call is it, which is passed in EAX. You have to pass this. Have to pass this somehow. Only one type of invoke syscall instruction. Unlike call, unlike a normal function call, where the function call says what function to call. Function call instruction includes what to call. I guess I should say one type, only one, no special parameters to, like, this revoke system call instruction is just an instruction that does that. It doesn't say what type of system call it is, so that information needs to be elsewhere. Okay. So then we have the generic trap handling code. In XV6, this is trapasm.s and traps.c, or trap.c. And this handles saving user registers. So kernel code can do what it likes, because otherwise the kernel code would need to worry about, what about all these registers that might contain stuff the user cares about? We solve that problem immediately. And looks up, stores what type of exception it is. Exception happened, in this case, system call, and later looks that up to invoke correct handler. So we store this because it's generic, because not just used for more than syscalls. So this is code which is the same code that would run if it wasn't a system call, but it stores that it was a syscall when it starts. So when it finishes, it can look that up and say, okay, we're doing the system call. And then we have the system call dispatch code called .c, which uses system call number to invoke correct handler. And the system call handler for the particular, system call implementation. C, which is, retrieves arguments from user stack, actually does requested operation.
So that's like the flow to invoke the system call. So we have the user part because this is sort of, this is because we want a function to call. So I should like remind people. So this is this what we call sort of the system call wrapper looks like, you know, provides C function interface to syscalls. That's why we can call it like a C function. Then we have our generic trap handling code because that's the same no matter what reason we enter the kernel. We have the same code which runs all the time. Then we have the specific code to like reverse engineer from what the trap handling code remembered. Oh, this is the system call I want to run. We actually do the operation. And at that point, we retrieve the arguments, which were stored on the user stack way back at the beginning. Because the code in the middle doesn't know it's a system call, like they aren't dealt with before then. Then we have the, and then returning from a system call, returning from syscall goes through in reverse order, you know, up to exit the kernel to restore the user registers and so on. Some questions about that? Yeah. What? Why are we saving the user registers here? Because the kernel code is going to overwrite things like EAX, EBX, and if we don't save them, when we switch back to the user program, we'll have corrupted them. So these are saved. XV6 saves to the kernel stack. That's where XV6 is chosen to save those. Yeah. So it happens when we run this special instruction that causes an exception. So recall, exception implies enter kernel mode. Exception equals enter kernel mode. Where is this? Okay, other. Questions? Okay. So then we have questions on counting context switches. So I guess the thing to remember here is that, you know, a context switch happens when we need to run an application. We don't need to context switch to just make it so we can run an application later. That's just because, to clear out a process control block, etc. So I think this first one is, I think, what usually causes that if we make something runnable, we don't switch to it right away. Right? We can make something so it can run later. Like if I get a key press, I can make it so I can run the application later, but I don't need to run it right away. And if I'm not running it right away, I'm not switching to it. And we don't need a context switch to handle I/O. This is done, exception handler, you know, runs in whatever program is currently running. So we don't automatically context switch because of I/O. We run the exception handler in the program that's still already running and do whatever we need to do to handle that I/O without regard to what program it's for. We might do something like make another program runnable or edit another program's memory in response to that I/O, but the action of communicating with the device doesn't require us to switch away because once the exception happens, we're writing code that's allowed to do that. So I think that's usually what confuses people about counting context switches. Questions about? Yes, yeah.
So system call would not be a context switch, though?
So system call is not a context switch because we don't
The system call itself, like at no point here did I switch what application I'm going to run. Right? If I exit the kernel, I'm still back in the original application. Now, system call can cause a context switch, and that would just be because the requested operation involves doing a context switch. Like if it involves waiting for something to happen, the way we wait is we switch away. And I guess important thing is that a context switch doesn't equal a mode switch. Mode switch, you know, kernel versus user. So the question is, if we switch to running the scheduler and go back to the same program, would that be considered a context switch? That's ambiguous. So like, if we end up asking that, you can like answer either way and make it clearer how you're counting that. It's ambiguous because like usually we like consider the scheduler not really something we switch to, but yeah. But you're not wrong for saying like we context switch to the scheduler and then something else. So context switching and stacks. So in XV6 and many other OSs, the saving user registers is handled using handled when exceptions happen. Works the same way no matter whether there's a context switch or not. No. So we need to save the user registers. If we're running an exception code, even if we're not going back to the same program when we're done, we're not changing address spaces, we're not switching away in any way. That's not a context switch, but we save the registers the same way we save registers when you do a function call. So the same sort of way, like not exactly the same. Same idea as why we save registers for a function call. So that happens, and that handles saving the user part of the registers because we have chosen to only do the actual context switch operation in the kernel. So when we decide to do a context switch, we've already had an exception happen. And that means that we don't need to save, so we don't need to do anything extra to save user registers. So they're already saved, we're not gonna change where they are. They're gonna be the same place they would be during a system call or during an IO interrupt. So, do need to save kernel information. So in XV6, kernel information for actual switch operation and restore it from the destination process. Restoring the user information is done using the same way we return from an exception if there were no context switch. So same idea as returning from a function call that saved registers. So in XV6, the kernel stack the switch context switch pushes kernel registers onto kernel stack. And that's where context is saved. And exception, entering the kernel for an exception pushes user registers on kernel stack. And that's where user registers are saved. And I should say that's where it is, where kernel registers are saved when thread not running. Okay, so questions? Look like maybe, okay, so anything else on breach conditions? Okay, so then we have fork. So remember, so fork copies everything. So there, so after fork, nothing is, after fork, there are two programs and nothing is shared. You know, two processes, I should say, just to be precise, and nothing is shared between them. So this means that if I have local, this, and then I, you know, use local, global, etc. Here, So I'll have like mark this code **. So the code labeled *** will run in two processes, assuming fork doesn't fail. Parent in the child. Child, it will have separate copies of the global and local. So there is no way that what the parent does with global and local after forking will affect the child and vice versa. Okay. So, and it will also, same is true of the set of file descriptors, though they'll still point to the same file. Same files, pipes, etc. So, like manipulating the file descriptors by closing them, opening new ones, and so on, and the parent won't affect the child, and vice versa. Yeah?
It looks like one of those variables is actually a pointer, like in local, pointer to an integer, would the address be the same if they both change?
So, we're saying, you know, local pointer parent star local pointer. So So it will have the same value, and because we have, you know, address translation, it's possible, the parent and child will have the same set of addresses allocated. Have the same virtual addresses allocated. And the same virtual addresses for everything immediately after fork. Yes, so you're right, yeah. The addresses will be the same, they'll all be independent, yeah, but they'll have all the same addresses. If we didn't do that, it would be like really tricky to implement fork. We'd have to like edit all the pointers on the stack. That'd be kind of annoying. Yeah, question back there? What would cause fork to fail? So if fork works, you know, you know, enough memory, et cetera. So like the main things which cause fork to fail are you're out of memory or you're out of entries in a kernel data structure or some other resource exhaustion. Okay, other questions about fork? Yeah.
So with the pointer example, they both copy of local pointer.
So question is, does local pointer point to the same piece of data? So local pointer contains the same virtual address in both the parent and the child after fork happens. And star local pointer contains the same value, what the pointer points to, but they're independent copies. So even though it has the same virtual address, what it points to, like, because the parent and child have separate page tables, you know, the corresponding page table entry has a different physical page, so editing, modifying one won't modify the other when we actually do that address translation. Okay. Yeah.
So like if you were like call API or like have the child like edit local point on the value, I like to run into an edit value and then check after it's just running, like you won't be able to access what the parent has then.
So the question is, if the child like waits for the parent to do something and then checks its values, it won't notice what the parent did? Yeah. Not through its contents of its memory. Other questions? Okay, so that's on fork. So for multi-level feedback queues, estimating how long things run or how long it is until things start running. So the way I like thinking about this is idea of MLFQ is that things with short CPU bursts settle at a higher priority than things with a long CPU burst. So the sort of back of the envelope, so this implies a back of the envelope model is pretend everything has static priorities. And look at how much time, so look at how much time, you know, is left for program A after everything with higher priority than A runs as much as it wants to. So we think about, so you know, you say if these things are going to be at a higher priority, they're going to run first. Therefore, you know, they need all their time, and whatever's left over is when this other thing can run. And you know, if everything else is at a lower priority, you don't have to worry about it. You know, don't need to consider things at lower priority. In figuring out lower priority than A, in figuring out how much A runs. Right, because that's the idea of priority, is that if you have a higher priority, you know, you get to run first. So that's the back of the envelope model. Now, this is the back of the envelope because, you know, you might have to worry about sort of special cases. So I think in the problems people are alluding to, like, it was approximate enough that this back of the envelope would get you there. But, you know, need to do extra work if might have multiple things of the same priority, and, or, you know, priorities are fluctuating. So that's sort of the high level, how do I look at this situation? You know, If you want to do the full analysis, you can like actually sort of simulate what happens. So non-envelope, simulate what happens, you know, track priorities of everything, and just say, this runs for X, you know, MS, then, and so on. But for the most part, you should start with the back of the envelope and see if that gets you enough to like know what's roughly going on. For estimating how long until things start running, I guess, well, this is probably more general. So for things with fluctuating priorities, you know, use the time quantum to limit time quantum limits how long they can be at the higher priority. So, e.g., if program B can sometimes be at higher priority than A, it can only do so for, you know, time quantum at that quantum at that higher priority. Amount of time each time it gets to run. Right. So, like, that's all it can do, so you can limit that. And that was the idea for the quiz question, is that you say, oh, we can have two things at a higher priority, but we can limit how much they run by their time quantum or how much time they want to run. But even if it fluctuates, you have that sort of safety valve of, you know, that's the maximum interruption until they get demoted, until they somehow stop using the CPU and get promoted again, or otherwise get promoted. So questions about sort of, like, the key thing is this high level model that you should have is that we're at these higher priorities, the worst that, I only need to worry about the things at higher priorities, and I need to read the question to figure out, am I worried about sort of the average over time or the worst case, but you know, I'm just only going to be concerned about how much do they get to run. Yeah.
Can you explain the difference between back of envelope and non-back envelope? I'm a little
confused. So back of envelope, I mean, like, this is ignoring details, right? Like, I'm not, like, actually computing a schedule. So, for example, let's say I know A, like, becomes runnable at certain times. Like, that might affect the exact schedule. Like, I'm not taking those sorts of factors into account. That's what I mean by back of envelope, that it's, like, you know, I'm not taking some details into account, assuming they're not important, but it could be the case like that, you know, A never gets delayed because it always runs when everything else doesn't want to run, or something silly like that, and we're just not caring about that for this approximation. Yeah?
Oh, this is separate, but also, can we go over CFS, or is that. We'll
ask about that at the end after I go through everything else that's on the list. As soon as, if I have time, we'll see. Okay, so other questions on this sort of estimating MLFQ timing? I guess I should say. For the non-back of the envelope, it matters, like, if the priorities are fluctuating, that back of the envelope doesn't work, and if, like, it matters exactly when things become runnable, like, if they're, like, going to be synchronized, then that might not be sufficient. Like, if everything wants to run at the same time, and you care about the difference between that and everything wants to run at a random time, then, well, we didn't take into account when they went to run. Okay, so then we have a question on monitors and mutexes versus semaphores. So condition variable. So semaphores combine exclusive. critical section, you know, functionality, that's critical section, plus mutual exclusion, and wait for event functionality. That's the key where, you know, versus monitors, locks for first part, for crit sections, and CVs for wait for event. That's sort of the key conceptual difference. The other thing is semaphores have memory, even if you're using them for wait for event, have memory. So remember a count versus, you know, a count of number of things that are allowed to wake up, basically. Wake up. Conditioned CVs just deal with things that are already waiting. Already waiting, don't track, you know, waking something up on a CV now won't affect things that start waiting later. So that's a key difference that semaphores, if you start waiting later, you could be woken up because someone called post earlier. Whereas with condition variables, if you start waiting, all you have to think about is who's going to call signal or broadcast after I start waiting. And this is sort of both an advantage and a disadvantage as far as reasoning about what happens. And I guess, so common semaphore patterns are, you know, so we have the lock, which is a semaphore with value 1, value, initial value 1, lock equals wait / down, unlock equals post / up. And sort of a gate pattern, which is a semaphore with init value 0, let a waiting thread go equals post / up, wait for someone to let me go equals wait / down. Those are sort of the most common patterns you'll see with semaphores. So this gate pattern, this is the name I use, it's not like an official name. No, this is kind of like what you want for CV, like CVs. What you could use to implement CVs if you track how many times you want to wake up a waiter. And sort of resource tracking, you know, reserve resource equals wait down, reserve resource or wait for to be available, and free up resource equals post / up, versus we have common monitor patterns is lock always, so is lock when manipulating shared data, while we can't do what we want to do, pthread, you know, I guess cond wait, some CV, some lock. If a thread might be able to do what it wants to do, con signal broadcast, some CV. Okay, so those are sort of our general patterns. And you can map one to the other. But like the way we think about the problem is probably a bit different. So questions? Monitors versus semaphores in my sort of high level, what are your patterns with them? Question is, what does a CV do while it's waiting?
Like,
So a CV is a basically a container for a list of waiting threads. So if you wait on a CV, you're adding the current thread to that list and hopefully telling the scheduler to run something else. Whether you think, like, I don't know whether you'd say the CV is doing any of that or not, but like it's just containing the list of waiting threads. Your question? Yeah.
So a monitor in combination with data structures like can serve all the three roles of the thread, right?
So I guess, yeah, a monitor, monitors and semaphores, monitors equals mutex plus CVs plus data. Like that's what we mean by a monitor. And it can do, you know, can accomplish the same thing a semaphore that semaphores plus data can do. Yeah.
So with semaphores, do you need a lock to like re-implement kind of the same monitor behavior? Or you can just like act as semaphores in any
The question way? Is, do we need a lock with the semaphores? If you want a lock with semaphores, you got one. And
but like do you need a lock to modify like gates for multiple threads?
So the question is, do you need a lock to modify like a gate type semaphore for multiple threads? No. But if you have any shared data, you will need a lock for that. Okay. And I guess, right, this was tied in with that. So then, here. So then there was a question on on this, which was reader-writer lock. So I guess we can go over what a reader-writer lock is here. So reader-writer lock. So commonly, it is okay to have multiple threads read something at the same time, but only if no thread is modifying it. So that's a very common pattern. So reader-writer locks. So reader-writer locks are an extension of locks that, you know, support this well. So we would have correct behavior if we just did a normal lock, but you know, act like lock. So have two types of lock operations. So read lock says, you know, wait until there are no writers, and write lock says wait until no readers or writers. And considered a reader writer when you have a read / write lock and haven't unlocked it. So that's what we define as a reader or writer. We don't actually check if you're really accessing it, just that you've called this read or write lock operation and haven't called the corresponding unlock operation. So this helps support doing this pattern, and the idea is that like we're going to do better than if we just had a lock, because we'll allow multiple things that are just doing a read lock to run in parallel, whereas previously with a normal lock, they'd have to take turns. That's what reader-writer locks are. And the question from Spring 2019 was a reader-writer lock where we have a maximum number of allowed readers. So, you know, so this means that we have a new condition for read lock, which is wait until there are no writers and there are less than the maximum number of allowed readers. So we have that modify condition. So we need to edit our reader-writer lock code to handle that. So this means that, you know, so with monitors, we're going to have a, you know, in read lock, we want to do while
no writers and less than max number of readers, cond wait. So that's going to be our key thing we're doing. But we have to do some extra work to make that work correctly. So also need to make sure the CV is signaled when this new condition changes. So this means, so for example, in read unlock, we need to say if there are now less than, you know, well, read unlock, we want to con signal to wake up A because we decreased the number of readers. Yeah.
Did you get the conditions?
What?
I think you got the conditions of the while loop backwards.
While no writers, sorry. While no writers, sorry. Or max number, yes. So the question is, I got the while condition backwards, yes, sorry. While there's no while there are writers or the max number, I was thinking in reverse. Yes. While there are writers, we're going to wait until that's true. So we're going to loop while it's not true. So while there are writers or we have the max number of readers, we're going to wait. And because this max number of readers is something new, we need to signal when it might have changed. So the simplest way of doing that is to say, oh, on read unlock, we went to signal because we decreased the number of readers. Now, there was another thing, and with writer priority. So the writer priority meant that we had an additional condition, and no writers are waiting for the lock. So to add that, we have or writer, I'll add this in a separate line, or writer waiting for the lock. And here we have if no writer waiting for the lock, signal writer, and we'll say this. I guess I'll just say there's a CV for readers and a CV for writers because we want to signal writers sometimes and readers other times. Okay, so that's sort of the pseudocode we get. And like in the case where we signal writers, like we could signal them unconditionally, but that would be wasteful. We want to make sure that a writer can go, meaning there's no readers. Wait, you're running.
This is kind of a general question on mutexes, but why do you have to get a while loop around?
So the question is why is there a while loop here? So I guess I'll put that up here. Need a while loop because spurious wake ups cond wait, you know, can just return for no reason, and because another thread could sneak in, could run in between when we stop waiting, and when we get the lock back. So example, if we're trying to dequeue, the other thread could dequeue first, even though we were woken up to dequeue. So like in your thread queue example, like someone else could finish running a task, get the lock after doing that, and dequeue before the thing that was woken up to dequeue actually does it. And this was a consequence of not having core scheduling, that we didn't have, you know, signal does not hand off the lock. If single handed off the lock, this wouldn't be a problem, but it doesn't. Other questions? That's our the sort of high-level overview of the reader writer lock. So then data races. So data races are, you know, sorry. So the question is, why am I only checking if there's no writer waiting for the lock? So what you wanted to do is, you know, why I only check no writer waiting. So one, if no thread is waiting to read, then this isn't a problem. Then consignal will notice that there's no thread waiting and you group fast. So, like, it's not actually expensive to signal on an, shouldn't be expensive to signal on an empty condition variable that no one's waiting on. So that's one reason. And it, like, doesn't do anything, wake up anything that shouldn't wake up. So another reason is that it's possible for two threads to read unlock before any read lock waiting thread finishes read lock. So we could have a timeline where thread A read unlock. So I guess it will do, we have thread C is read lock, trying to read lock, and thread D is trying to read lock. And these are both wait readers. And these are both waiting for the number of readers to go down. Then thread A read unlocks, and then thread B read unlocks. And we need it to be the case that both A and B signal. In this case, so that's important to make sure that happens. And that also needs to, like, so I'm worried about that. I guess that's not actually an issue. I thought that was. But there might be a scenario in which it matters. Oh, right. So, right. The issue is that then C finish read lock, and then. Oh, right. Yeah. So that this would be an issue because we need to signal. So should signal here. And if we are decreasing the number of readers, we might not do that if we check the number of readers. So you need to be very careful about that. And it's usually easier to just say, always signal once. Here, or else D won't wake up. So we'll say this A signals C. So if that makes sense, so that's the scenario, a scenario I'm trying to avoid by always signaling. There are other ways of avoiding it, but the general rule of thumb, make sure you think about, you know, what if other things run, what if the thing I signal doesn't run immediately? That's just the case to be worried about. So then data races. So data races are, you know, when we're, you know, accessing, so writing a value while another thread might be writing it. And this leads to unexpected behavior because, you know, the outcome, the result of the reads and writes, read or write might vary depending on the exact timing, you know, thread scheduling, how the compiler reorders things, how the processor reorders things. You know, so this often, but not always, leads to a bug. It's not guaranteed to lead to a bug. Like, there were some people in the third pool assignment, for example, who had what we call a benign data race, where, like, for example, where they, you know, set a flag and incremented a semaphore. Technically, the flag could have been checked before the increment was acted on, but wasn't actually a problem sometimes. Sometimes it is, depends how what you're doing. But, like, often this can lead to a bug, like, in lots of ways. So, like, the classic example of, like, a nasty bug it leads to that many people experience in the thread pool assignment is writing a map, you know, which is a typically red-black tree, while another thread is reading it, the write might update a pointer and delete it. The read might use the deleted pointer. That's an example of a bug that some of you had because of a data race. And delete the original. Say. So that's an example of a bug people really had that's pretty nasty and a big problem because of this data race. And whether it would happen depends on whether the read actually gets the deleted pointer or gets the new one. And sometimes it's going to get the new one and everything's fine. And sometimes you won't have a data race because you'll access different parts of the tree, of the red-black tree, which is why this is a particularly nasty category of bugs. So, questions, deadlocks that people go over, what people... Yeah?
So data race is just like a factor of you not properly implementing your locks?
Question, data race is a factor of you not properly implementing your locks? Not properly implementing some form of synchronization. It doesn't have to be locks. So, for example, pthread join is a form of synchronization that could prevent a data race. Or like reading from a pipe, like in some scenario might prevent a data race. But you need something to make sure things happen in a particular order. Okay, other questions? Okay, so then we have deadlocks. So maybe the thing to go over with deadlocks is, yeah. So they're circular waiting. So I'm waiting for someone who's waiting for me. Most common is I have a lock, I've locked a lock. Lock A, and I'm trying to get lock B while someone else locked lock B and is trying to get lock A, but can have less direct chains, circular dependencies, you know, e.g. more than two threads. Threads, not just locks, etc. But that sort of circular dependency. And deadlocks, you know, not the only cause of threads hanging. So a lot of people, like in the thread pool assignment, would say, I have a deadlock. Well, most of the time you didn't. Most of the time you had a different type of hanging bug. So for example, not checking for a condition properly before waiting, before found waiting, can cause hanging, but not a deadlock. Like, the bug is that you're waiting when you're not supposed to. No. A deadlock, not supposed to be waiting. In deadlock, we are supposed to be waiting. The issue is that the thing we're waiting for can't finish. Starvation, we mentioned, is not hanging. You know, not actually a circular dependency. dependency. So for example, e.g. on, if you had a thread busy waiting that always got to run instead of threads actually doing computation, that would be, you might experience hanging if it got scheduled enough, but that wouldn't be a deadlock because, like, it's not actually dependency. Okay. So question on, so I gave the high level, yeah. So the question is, does starvation cause a deadlock? So starvation might cause hanging, but that's not a deadlock. So hanging is not, and like if the thread that is busy waiting always gets to run, the one that has the computation will never get to run. In practice, usually it won't be quite so extreme. Usually it will be something like the thread that's busy waiting, or threads that are busy waiting get like 80% of the CPU. So the thing that does computation just runs pretty slow. That's usually the form we see it in practice. So, in past semesters, I haven't seen any this semester, I've seen people who were busy waiting on the pool assignment experience the test run really slowly because of this sort of phenomenon where they had a bunch of threads just busy waiting that were hogging all the CPU time away from the threads that were actually like doing what the test was trying to do. It didn't hang, but it ran real slow. And running real slow, not a deadlock. So running real slow is not a deadlock, because with deadlock we have to do some intervention to stop it once we're in that situation. Okay, so questions on deadlock? Okay, so virtual memory, translating a virtual address to a physical address. So step one is split up the virtual address into pieces. So if we have two levels, we have our virtual address, and it's going to be so long, and we're going to have a virtual, I should write here, virtual page number, and a page offset. So the page offset is going to be big enough to have a unique number for each byte in the page. So e.g. 2 to the 12 byte pages applies 12 bits. And our virtual page number, we're going to split further into 1 and part 2. And each of these are going to be, so the BPM part 1, I should like be consistent here, is going to be an index into the first level page table, and VPN part 2 is going to be an index into the second level page table. So, and how many, size VPN part 1, 2 is going to be big enough to have one value for each possible index, So e.g. if 2 to the 10 item entries in the page table, which then we have 10 bits. So for the then, so look up first level. So we take the page table base pointer, is the beginning of array of first level of first level PTEs. So we access element VPN part one. So we're accessing like that array VPN part one. So we're computing that address. So it's going to be address of that array plus VPN part one times size of PTE. That's where it is. You know, PTE will contain valid bit. Is there a second level page table? Well, if no, then don't. If no, then stop. And a physical page number. You know, and we can convert physical page number to a physical address by adding an all zeros page offset, or by multiplying by page size. Both are equivalent. Right, we just need to get the beginning. We have something in pages, not bytes. Yeah. So it's convert from pages to bytes, because our addresses are in bytes. And step three is look up the second level. So same process as step two, but use the physical address we got from the PTE in step two, and use VPN part two instead of part one. Then step four is take the physical address we got from step three, add the page offset from the original VPN, the virtual address. And that's our result, is the physical address that will be accessed. Questions? Yeah.
So like in step two, when you're doing address of that array plus the pointer, are you actually adding, or are you just concatenating?
The question is, in step two, when I'm doing, concatenating. All right. Concatenating, yeah. Wait, so unit conversion is how you should think of it. Going from pages to bytes. Yeah.
So we only use the offset at the very end.
We only use the offset at the very end, is the question? Yes. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so then last, page faults, when do they happen? If we get to the then stop above. Or, you know, other metadata, other metadata in PTE says not writable, readable, etc., and we're trying to do a write-read, etc. So sometimes called a protection fault instead of page fault. We won't be precise about it, but you might see other sources not always call those protection faults, not page faults. Okay. So copy on write is, want to copy data. So simulate this. So, but not right now. Now we want to copy data, but not right now. So how do we do this? We mark the data read only. We will get a page fault when it's accessed. Copy when that page fault happens. And this guarantee is before the data is used, is modified. So before it matters, before we lose our chance to copy, you know, and we lose our chance to preserve the original value. So we're doing it before it modifies so we don't lose the original value. And so on a page fault, relies on page faults letting us change the page table and retry the operation. So, and that's how page faults work. So when a page fault happens, if we return from the page fault without doing anything, the processor is just going to do that again. If we return after fixing it, the processor will try it again, and it will do something different. And that's by design, so we can implement things like copy and write. So questions? Yes, back there. Yes. I am going to post these notes, yes. Sorry, CFS? Okay, so CFS, so the key idea is this notion of virtual time. So this is scaled actual time a program has been run, and fairness, and main goal is fairness in virtual time. So this implies highest priority to run equals lowest virtual time. So that's sort of the high level overview, is that we're just letting things run for the same amount of time by running whatever hasn't run enough. So secondary goal is, don't let things that have been unrunnable for a long time, haven't run for a very long time, get a huge advantage. Example, if I walk away from my email client for 1 hour, it shouldn't get all the CPU time when I come back. Get all the CPU time when I come back. And the solution, so we have multiple secondary goals. Solution is adjust virtual time within a limit when things come back after waiting a while. And so those are like the high level things. So another secondary goal is run thing, manage context switch overhead. So solution is adjust time quantum, don't switch to lowest virtual time so often that we're always context switching. Context switching, set minimum time quantum and normal based on number of things running and parameters. So questions on? Sorry?
In the secondary goal one, you don't let things that have been running, maybe we haven't forecasted.
So shouldn't we have?
Don't let things that have been run for a long time. Should we have been
run? That have been run, have not been run. Yeah, the question is that have not been run for a long time get a huge advantage. Things which have run for a long time naturally get a disadvantage because they have a higher virtual time. So other questions? Okay, so see you on Tuesday. Or Thursday.